Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, literature, art, and the idea of freedom during the Cold War. Louis Menand has been thinking about that. His new book is The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War. But first, we're still thinking about that new biography of Philip Roth and how the publisher took it out of print right after publication because the author, Blake Bailey, was accused of rape and other terrible things. For comment, we turn to Katha Pollitt. Of course, she's an award-winning poet, essayist, and columnist for The Nation. We reached her today in Connecticut. Hi, Katha.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm great.
Well, just in case people have forgotten the details, please remind us what we learned about Philip Roth's official biographer, Blake Bailey, in the last few weeks.
Oh, this is so terrible. Blake Bailey publishes this book to tremendous acclaim. He's the toast of the town. But a few days later, he was toast. And that was because it came out that several of his students, his former students, when he was a middle school teacher in the 90s in New Orleans, came forward with accusations that he had, the word they use is groomed them when they were ages like 12 and 13. And then he kept up with them through high school. And then when they turned legal, he came after them. And one says he raped her and others described, you know, really disgusting scenarios. Then a few days after that, New York publishing executive named Valentina Rice said that she had been raped by him in 2015. And that she had written to his publisher, Norton, using a pseudonym, saying that this had happened and volunteering to give them corroborating information as if they could preserve her privacy. And they had not even written back to her. Instead, they forwarded her email to Blake Bailey, who, of course, could figure out who it was, and they just went ahead with the publication of the book. And he wrote to her and he said, you know, of course this never happened, but please don't say anything about this because my wife and daughter adore and depend on me and this would destroy them, even an untrue rumor. And I think I can't figure that out. I mean, I didn't do this, but don't tell anybody. That's kind of strange. And then one other former student came out and claimed that he had attempted to rape her. So anyway, the weight of all this was very great. And eventually Norton first paused distribution and publicity, and then it said, we're taking the book out of print.
And who exactly is Blake Bailey? What had he written that led Philip Roth to name him his authorized biographer?
He had written well-received biographies of John Cheever and Richard Yates. and the author of a once famous, very famous novel called The Lost Weekend. So he had, you know, very good credentials. It's just he was a bad person.
Well, I'm one of the old white men who grew up reading all of Philip Roth and loved many of them, especially, of course, Portnoy's Complaint back in the late 60s. And also, I loved his 1993 book, Operation Shylock. That's the one where Philip Roth, in the first person, goes to Israel to cover the trial of a Nazi concentration camp guard. And he meets this horrible man who has been telling the world that he is the real Philip Roth. But this guy says terrible things about the Jews that our protagonist would never say, because the real Philip Roth is a decent, good person. I thought this was incredibly clever and fun. And of course, I love The Plot Against America, which is the one about how if Lindbergh had defeated FDR in 1940 and America had become a fascist state. He wrote that in 2004, 12 years before Trump. The only one I really hated was American Pastoral. That's the one about the late 60s, a Jewish businessman has a daughter who becomes an anti-war fanatic and underground terrorist and sinister sex bomb, a ridiculous idea about activist women in the 60s. But I have to acknowledge that American Pastoral won the Pulitzer Prize in 1998. The New York Times Book Review had a contest in 2006. What is the best work of American fiction of the last 25 years? Toni Morrison's Beloved came in first. American Pastoral tied for second with Don DeLillo's Underworld and John Updike's Rabbit novels. Shows what I know. I do know that most feminists hate his work for its portrayal of women, and not just American Pastoral. Where do you stand on the question of Philip Roth?
Well, I've enjoyed many novels by Philip Roth. You mentioned The Plot Against America. I like that one a lot. I like The Counterlife a lot. I thought The Human Stain was very great. And talking about Prescient, The Human Stain, it's all about, you know, what we now know as, quote, cancel culture, unquote, and language perfectionism in academia.
This was the one, let me just remind people, about the professor who is falsely, mistakenly accused of making racist statements and driven out of academia. And it's based on a real incident involving my old advisor at Princeton, Mel Tooman, who wasn't driven out of academia, but grew up with Philip Roth.
Well, that's very interesting, because a lot of people thought it was based on Anatole Breillard.
Combination.
So anyway, and then, you know, after I wrote my column and all like this, I thought, well, I should read some more Philip Roth. So I got the one that people say is the most misogynistic of every book ever written, which is Sabbath's Theater. And I started and I was reading it out loud to my husband. And, you know, by page five, that man is a brilliant storyteller. By page five, I thought, yeah, I'm going to read this. I'm going to finish this. He really is a wonderful prose stylist. And he is a brilliant storyteller. And, you know, if you didn't read books that have a lot of misogyny in them, there would be very little to read.
Okay, so that's where you stand on the question of Philip Roth. Where do you stand on the question of Blake Bailey? Assuming we believe the women, he did do these terrible things to his students and to adult women. Should his biography of Philip Roth have been taken out of print by Norton?
Well, I see their problem. I see their problem because their lackadaisical behavior about that original email and all that makes them kind of vulnerable. And also, how could you ask the publicist to continue working on, you know, booking talks and lectures and things for Blake Bailey? That would be very hard to do because all publicists basically are women.
Young, just out of college women.
Out of college women. But, you know, the other side of it is, I think I would want to read this book if I was interested in Philip Roth. It's written in a very fluent way. It's very readable. And that cannot be said of all books, or even especially all biographies. And it contains a tremendous amount of information. So I would say I don't think it should be taken out of print. I think there must be some way to deal with it being available to the public, and yet, you know, maybe make all the money go to rape victim foundations and things like that. I just don't like the idea of taking books away from people, including books I don't like.
And why do you think these charges against Blake Bailey came out only now? You make this wonderful sentence in your column that if he'd written a biography of Eisenhower, this never would have happened. What exactly do you mean?
Well, I think it's because the charges against Blake Bailey, the accusations, they rhyme with an opinion of Philip Roth that not everybody has, but a lot of people do, which is he is a vengeful narcissist. He's very misogynistic. He's manipulative to women. He's obsessed with sex, etc. Is like a Philip Roth novel, where like the one you described is where you've got your doppelganger, and your doppelganger is worse than you are. Well, I think these people have these women have been trying to get this story out, and it only came out afterwards. If it had come out before, we might never have had the book. But then, you know, there's the question too of like, how bad can you be? How evil can you be and not be able to publish a book? I mean, a lot of writers are terrible people, just like a lot of non-writers are terrible people.
Well, you know, I made a list. Wagner was a vicious anti-Semite, Hitler's favorite composer. Caravaggio murdered somebody in Sicily. Picasso was horrible to Dora Maar and then painted her crying. And of course, you don't have to listen to Wagner. You don't have to look at a Caravaggio painting or a Picasso painting. But I think our point here is it should be up to you to decide. It shouldn't be taken away so nobody can.
Yes, I think of that. And you know what they say? They say comedy is tragedy plus time. So, you know, Caravaggio lived a long time ago. That makes it a little, and even Picasso lived a long time ago, although not long enough. But more contemporary examples would be, I mean, Norman Mailer stabbed his wife. William Burroughs killed his wife.
Eldridge Cleaver wrote a book about being a rapist.
He did. And Althusser killed his wife. I mean, there's a lot of terrible things that have gone on quite recently. And I think that up until now, high culture, literary culture, academic culture has not said, oh, no, we're not going to read books by these people. We're not going to study Althusser. Now, maybe things are changing. A friend of mine says that young art history students don't want to study Picasso because of things like the thing you mentioned. And I don't know. I don't go along with that. I just think we need a very broad, big cultural repertoire to get ourselves through life. Now, here's an interesting thing. There was a wonderful PBS documentary about Hemingway by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. And I thought they got it exactly right. They managed both to tell you why he was a great writer. I mean, they actually looked at his prose, which Blake Bailey does not do. He's very weak on the actual literary qualities of Philip Roth's work. But alongside the very useful look at Ernest Hemingway's writing, they also showed you that he was in many ways a very damaged, bad person. You know, terrible to wives, terrible to certain of his children. He tried to sabotage the brilliant journalist Martha Gellhorn, who he was married to at the time. He tried to sabotage her career in numerous ways because he was jealous. And yet you felt great pity for him. You know, I mean, you felt great sorrow for the wreckage of his life and all the lies he told. I mean, a lot of the stuff we believe about Ernest Hemingway is not true. It's kind of amazing. And I think that's the way to do it. You have to hold both things. You know, you can't say, well, he was a great writer, so none of this matters. It does matter. But you can't dismiss the writing because of the failings of the human being.
Katha Pollitt wrote about Blake Bailey in Philip Roth. You can read her new column at thenation.com. Thank you, Katha. This was great.
Thanks for having me, John.
Now it's time to talk about the idea of freedom during the Cold War. For that, we turn to Louis Menand. His new book is The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He teaches English at Harvard, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for his last book, The Metaphysical Club. We talked about it here. And he was awarded the National Humanities Medal by President Barack Obama, along with Wynton Marsalis and Terry Gross. Luke Menand, welcome back.
Thank you, John.
Well, let's start with what this book is not. It's not a book about the cultural Cold War, the official use of culture as a weapon against the Soviet Union, for example, sending Duke Ellington on a world tour as an example of American freedom. And it's not about Cold War culture, the way American films and novels and paintings expressed ideas about the Cold War. For example, my favorite, the movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where the pod people look just like your neighbors, but their minds have been taken over by a sinister and alien force. So what is this book about?
So this is just a cultural intellectual history focused on the period 1945 to 1965, that is to say, from the end of the Second World War to the year the U.S. intervened militarily in Vietnam. And the Cold War is definitely an important context for that history, but it's not the only context. So I try to put it in its proper perspective, looking at it from the point of view of the people who were making works of art and composing music and writing books in that period.
It's a big book, 726 pages of text, and covers pretty much everything. I want to take a few key examples that I hope illuminate the larger issues. The first writer to use the term Cold War to describe the post-war world was George Orwell. Of course, his book 1984 was the key work here, published in 1949, sold 2 million copies by 1956. When I read 1984 in high school, I was taught the book was about what the United States would look like if the communists took over. We'd have Big Brother is Watching You and the Ministry of Truth and War is Peace. But was that Orwell's purpose to warn against a communist takeover?
I don't think that it was. It's interesting that right after the war, Orwell wrote an article saying that he worried about various possible futures, and one of them was that there would be a Cold War. So from Orwell's point of view, what 1984 shows is what it would look like if the world were engaged in a Cold War, which would be these interminable and unwinnable struggles between these massive superpowers. In the novel, as you remember, there's three of these sort of enormous states, Eurasia, East Asia, and Oceania, and they're constantly fighting with each other and then changing their alliances and fighting all over again. I think what Orwell had in mind there was the relationship between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, who were allies until they weren't. But that's what he worried would happen. He actually says in this article, it'd be better if we just all got wiped out by nuclear bombs and could start over again than if we entered into this struggle. But that book became a Bible for Cold Warriors on every point in the political spectrum, because it seemed to them to indicate what the world would be like if we didn't fight a Cold War.
So totalitarianism was the first big theme of Cold War thought, which was, of course, the opposite of freedom. And then there was existentialism. Man is condemned to be free, even though man has a strong desire to escape from freedom. This is a specific idea, you show, that arose in a specific context that then became the general idea of the era.
Yeah, you know, the 1945, the Germans call it zero hour. And that was true in France, too, because once the occupation ended, there was an opportunity to begin again with a clean slate. And lots of people in France had an interest in doing that because their role during the occupation wasn't all that noble. So there was room for a culture hero to walk on the stage. And as if on cue, one did, Jean-Paul Sartre. He was ready to run in 1945 with existentialism. And it caught on in France. It became, of course, subject of enormous controversy in France. And then it spread to the U.S. because it was covered widely in American publications like Partisan Review. And there was a period when existentialism just flooded the cultural field. Everybody thought about jazz and painting and lifestyles in terms of existentialism. So that's, I would say, of the post-war schools of thought, that's the first in line.
One of my favorite chapters in your book is the one about the Family of Man, the photo exhibition that opened at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City in 1955. It broke attendance records there. Then it was sent around the country and around the world, eventually to 87 venues in 37 countries, seen by 9 million people. The paperback sold more than 4 million copies. I still remember my family's copy. Lots of my friends do. The idea was, quote, the essential oneness of mankind throughout the world, close quote. How did that become such a big deal in the dark days of the Cold War?
People love this show. So in terms of cultural diplomacy, it was by far the most effective exhibition that the U.S. mounted. What's interesting to me about the reputation of the Family of Man, probably because Roland Barthes wrote this famous critique of it in his first book, Mythologies, is that it's regarded as a kind of piece of U.S. propaganda. So what was interesting to me when I researched it is that the people who really loved the show were the communist press. The Daily Worker ran many pieces about how great it was. And when it went to France, which is where Roland Barthes either saw it or didn't see it, also the communist press in Paris all published these encomia to the Family of Man. Why was that? Because that was the Soviet line. World peace through common understanding. That peace was their slogan as freedom was our slogan. So they saw the show as fitting exactly with what the communist propaganda wanted. And when it went to Moscow, it was part of this big exhibition in Moscow, that the famous exhibition where Richard Nixon and Khrushchev get into the kitchen debate. It was extremely popular in Moscow as well, seen by millions of Muscovites. So it has an interesting history because it has a reputation of being kind of the opposite of the way it was received. Of course, the message of peace through understanding is an anodyne message, so anybody can sign off on it.
We need to talk about James Baldwin, who, of course, has had a huge renaissance in the last few years. He started out in the 50s as an expat living in Paris while the early battles over segregation in the South were underway. In 1957, James Baldwin published a piece I learned from your book about William Faulkner, a literary icon in the 50s. White liberals considered Faulkner a man of broad humanist sympathies who understood the Southern point of view and spoke with authority on race relations. Your words. What was Baldwin's piece about?
So Faulkner had given this interview in which he said he deplored the extremism of anti-segregationists in the South. So this is in 1956. It's just the only movement in the South that was going on was the bus boycott, which is hardly an extremist effort. And he said that although he was supported integration sort of as a goal, he would go out in the streets and shoot Negroes for Mississippi and the United States. So he probably drunk when he gave this interview, but that didn't prevent people from reprinting it. And I think Partisan Review gave it to Baldwin to write a piece about it, and Baldwin went after Faulkner. That was important because by that point, Faulkner had won the Nobel Prize. He was highly esteemed. He won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. He was highly esteemed as an American author. His career rescued after years of neglect. And I think a lot of Northern whites thought he speaks with authority. He's a Southerner who understands the race problem. Baldwin says, no, where have you been? He said, if you're serious about this. So that was an important piece. He was a brave guy, Baldwin.
Then Baldwin became a bestseller in 1961 with his essay collection, Nobody Knows My Name, and then his novel, Another Country, in 1962. Then in 63, he was on the cover of Time magazine, but I was a little surprised to learn from your book he was not universally celebrated by liberals. Hannah Arendt didn't like his work. Susan Sontag didn't like his work. The first issue of the New York Review of Books didn't like his book. Why not?
Yeah, the first issue of the New York Review of Books, the very first page is an attack on the fire next time. The reason I think is pretty simple. Baldwin's position was that whites, liberals or not, have to own their part in white supremacy. And white liberals don't like to hear that. They don't associate themselves with segregationists, prejudiced people. And there was a backlash against Baldwin right at the height of his renown, 1963, when he publishes The Fire Next Time, which is an incredible book. You start to get people like Sontag attacking him. And I think it really drove him off the main stage. He kind of lost the white audience. And then for a long time, his career went on for quite a while. His books were neglected, or Irving Howe attacked his novels. It was pretty unpleasant. And then, of course, about 5 or 6 years ago, he gets resurrected because he's sending the same message that Black Lives Matter protesters said today, which is white people have to own their part in this system. And a lot of white people don't want to hear that.
Kind of the end of your story in the mid-60s with the war in Vietnam, the idea that the United States was fighting for the idea of freedom did have a sudden and dramatic ending. The discovery that the campaign for cultural freedom was being funded by the CIA. That was the work of Rampart's magazine in 1967, which exposed the fact that the CIA had set up a series of dummy foundations which were funneling money to liberal organizations and publications, starting with the National Student Association, and including most famously a magazine, liberal magazine called Encounter. As a student, I was hired to do some of the research for that story in Rampart. So I'm very interested in it. Why was CIA funding of the Cultural Cold War such a huge thing for American intellectuals?
Well, let's just take the example of Encounter magazine. So Encounter magazine was published by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which is headquartered in Paris, which is ostensibly an independent organization, but actually it was entirely a creature of the agency. And it published magazines in European countries. There was one in Germany, Der Monat. There was one in France, one in Spain, and so on. And Encounter was the one published in London. And the editor of Encounter was a CIA agent. This was not known to the intellectuals who published. Almost every important intellectual you could imagine, the Trillings, Dwight MacDonald, everybody, published in Encounter. It was like Partisan Review, in effect. And they didn't realize that they were being paid by the CIA. And when that comes out, actually, a little before the Ramparts piece, but not until the Ramparts piece does it really blow up in 1967, it casts a light on what everybody had been doing for 20 years, which is to say that intellectuals thought of themselves as independent from the state. They could be critical of the state. They didn't think they were dancing to the state's tune. And suddenly, when it turns out they're creatures of the state, they're saying exactly what the state wants them to say, it's a big crisis. Christopher Lash, of course, wrote a very famous article about this. It showed up the kind of hypocrisy of establishment intellectuals in the United States. I think that's an extreme version, interpretation of it, but that's how it was interpreted. So when you get to that point in my story, you look back, you think, like, what was really going on here? You know, who was paying the piper, as people say.
But of course, the defense of all those people who wrote for all those magazines, well, nobody ever told me what to say. And I criticized parts of the United States in my article.
But they didn't have to tell them what to say. That's the whole beauty of it. They were saying exactly what they were supposed to be saying. It's not true that people didn't get censored. Dwight MacDonald famously had a piece killed by Encounter that was a little too extremely anti-US. So they carefully controlled. Same with the NSA. The NSA is the National Student Association, as you say, John. That was the story that Rampart's scooped, uncovered, that started to unravel the whole tapestry. There, too, they were very careful about making sure that the leadership of the NSA, which is a pretty big organization, had international connections and so on, that the leadership was compatible with U.S. policy. There was a crisis looming for the NSA, which was Vietnam. And if the NSA had become anti-war, then it would have been a problem for the government, because obviously you couldn't use government money to support an anti-war group. But that's another case where the CIA is just behind the scenes, making sure that everything's running exactly the way the government wants it.
So where do we end up with the idea of freedom in the Cold War? Writers in the 50s regarded it as the most important good in life. But today, of course, freedom is a right-wing idea. It's what Republicans say the federal government is taking away from us meaning mostly white men, that freedom not to wear masks against COVID-19. Did they inherit that idea from the Cold War critique of totalitarianism? Was freedom mostly Cold War ideology? Does the concept of freedom that we have today really have any value if we're not Republicans?
It's an impossibly mercurial concept. Everybody appropriates it. Martin Luther King uses the word freedom 20 times in the I Have a Dream speech. Mm-hmm. He uses the word equality only once. George Wallace uses the word freedom in his inaugural address as governor of Alabama, where he calls for segregation now and forever. One of the most famous lines about freedom out of 1964 is extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Barry Goldwater. So everybody's on board the freedom train to the point where it doesn't really mean a whole lot. I think it means something to each person who uses it, but it's very hard to generalize about the meaning of the term. The concept of freedom from the state and so forth is just deeply rooted in American history, as you know. So it's not something that was invented in 1945.
Everybody's on board the freedom train. Louis Menand, his new book is The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War. It's a great one. Luke, thanks for talking with us today.
Always a pleasure, John. Thank you.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Our audio engineer is William Broughton. Alan Minsky is our senior producer. Frank Reynolds is our executive producer. Annie Shields is The Nation's engagement editor. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. You can subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts, at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Pocket Casts. I'm John Wiener. Tune in to Start Making Sense next week for more political talk without the boring parts.